question. Does the concept of art come before you make a verdict in terms of its quality? And also, is there what you call a universal take on art?
Let's have the first one. Let's have the concept.
Yeah.
You've been reading philosophy too.
You gave it to us.
Kant, when he talks about the concept, really means something like this. He says, now you're all set to experience art, that's all. You're not set to play with your child or cook dinner. You're set now to experience art. And I think that's what Kant meant, because he expresses himself very not loosely, but very freely at times. He was one of the two greatest minds we have any record of, at least in the West. But his mind would run so thoroughly over that he'd come up with 10 different ways of expressing what he meant, each one like another facet in the crystal or in the gem. And when he uses the concept, the word concept there, I think he said, now you know what art is like, and you're about to, let's say, go to a movie or look at a picture or listen to music.
But he talks about it as being disinterested
yeah.
viewer, and that's what
yeah, well, meaning you're not going to art because you want to get anything out of it except the now pleasure or elation or exhilaration or satisfactions that we can only get from art, and not because we want to get a good mark in school, and not because we hope somehow to improve our health or physique or learn something, but simply for the experience itself, which is what I meant when I said art was an ultimate end, something whose value lay entirely in itself. And that means disinterested, because you're not interested in getting anything out of it except the experience itself.
But is it kind of necessary to have a certain preconception about what is quality?
No, not a preconception. That's a different word from concept.
Yeah.
No. Now, I'll get to that later, too. We can't go right to the end of the book this evening. Oh, well, no, this gentleman hasn't asked a question.
Well, I don't even know where to start, actually. First of all, I'd like to just make a comment on Kant. I mean, after all, Kant does say that it's not just a question of getting an experience of art, but in fact, art exhibits a non-purposive teleology, which is slightly more than that. But I don't want to get into
it. Well, it means the same thing, you know.
Well,
purpose without not purpose. Purposiveness.
Well, it has to do with the relation of
purposiveness without
the understanding
I see. Now, go ahead.
Forget about me. But look, what I really wanted to ask you was something like this. I'm not exactly sure what you're doing, and it bothers me in a certain way. And what I mean is something like this. But it seems to me that on the one hand, you're saying that ultimately, aesthetics cannot deal with art in a discursive manner, literally. I mean, because on the other hand, it seems to me that you seem to be wanting to explain, in fact, how it is that we experience art the way that we do. And
yeah.
Wait, can I finish my point? And then because it really is a confusion on my part, I think. Then it seems to me, when you talk about art for art's sake, what you do is you contrast it with all the possible external uses to art to which art can be put. I mean, it's things which really don't have much to do with the content of the art itself, such as religion. I mean, it may, but it may not. And then on the other hand, what you don't do is to try to deal with the notion that art might in fact have internal uses to which it could be put.
I'm sorry.
All right, I lose.
That's a well taken question, but I can't. Again, I'm afraid this is going to happen eight succeeding nights. I'm going to say, let's wait.
Okay.
Let's wait, Beth. Because, well, the beginning, what you said in the beginning was well taken. Here I say, art cannot be dealt with by discursive reasoning. Yeah. At the same time, here we are. Here I am saying, well, we can go around art this way, after all, using discourse, and we are circling around. I'm hoping to circle around art, using discourse. Now, what do I mean by saying that a discursive reason is largely helpless in the matter? Well, that I hope to elucidate.
And yeah, what I'm raising is not really an objection. Mm-hmm.
I didn't take it.
Yeah.
Can I get a glass of water?
Yeah.
This.
Yeah, I didn't mean to bleep out, Steve. No. My machine couldn't hear it. What I wanted to bring up was, I suppose, something that I think is preliminary, I hope it was, to the seminars, and that is things like a definition of culture and civilization. Now, I should have read, I did read the first essay in the book, and I think that maybe as it's written 30 years ago or so, that you might have, and I think under pressure, I know, not under political pressure, but certainly in a kind of a different state of mind than you are now.
Yes, indeed.
And I think that it would be interesting for me, and certainly I think maybe for other people here, your views now on culture, and I think you brought up a point with Eliot that he used culture and civilization synonymously. And if that's not, a further
question. You're asking for a prepared talk. Mm-hmm. A prepared talk I'm not equipped to give, I don't think. I can object to Eliot's exchanging the words culture and civilization, almost surreptitiously in his book on Notes Towards the Definition of Culture. But I don't think I can tell him or anyone else how to use those words more accurately. I could just notice that at one point he's talking about civilization, another point he's talking about seemingly the same entity, and he calls it culture. That's all. That piece I wrote in 1939, well, I saw something I thought was quite obvious then. And it had nothing to do with defining culture or civilization. It was just a matter of observing some things. I'd put my observations somewhat differently today, but not, I wouldn't put the substance much differently. I'd word them differently.
About the same time that you wrote that article, Herbert Read wrote an article called To Hell with Civilization. I don't know if you're aware of that. At the same time, which I'm not going to go and define it or say. But he says that, his article was To Hell with Culture. Now, he was all for getting rid of culture and keeping civilization. And I just feel that there's something important in this point, because they're both written at the same time when, I don't know the dates.
39.
But during or around the war, and there was very much, people were thinking that civilization or culture was really at a bad point because of the war. And yet, nowadays, I think people are still, it's like waiting, it was like in before the Renaissance, waiting for the end of the world, and it didn't come. And here we are 20 years later or so, or 30 years later, still waiting for the fall. of culture or civilization, and it hasn't come.
Well, we don't know about the millennial feelings just before the Renaissance. You may be thinking about the year 1000, and that famous, what's it called? The fear of the year 1000, when some people thought the world, yeah, the world was going to end, yeah. No, apocalypse or something. But anyway, now it's been decided by competent authorities that fear of the year 1000 is a retrospective myth in large part. I don't know, in 1939, and this is not germane to what we're talking about, there wasn't the atomic bomb, and what we did fear was there was going to be an enormous amount of destruction, and a lot of people were going to get killed, but not really that, thank you, that civilization was going to be destroyed. Now we have more reason with the atomic bomb to feel that kind of fear. And I don't know what it has to do with what we're talking about, but there's that huge difference between the way we felt in 39 and the way we feel today in 71. Excuse me, this gentleman hasn't had a chance to say anything.
Well, I wanted to say something in relation to what the person before me had said, and that's that I wish to suggest that our interest in civilization is somewhat provincial. And you had said that the West treats the individual as the ultimate end. And I would think...
I qualified myself, but I said, to a larger extent, it seems to me, than any other civilization.
Oh, right. You were modest about your assertion, but you made the assertion. And I would think that, in the light of the fact that the West has had more impressive political and military successes in the last several hundred years, I would think that it's an illusion that the East would treat the individual any less significantly.
That's one of these words that...
Well, I'm particularly interested in the word treat, actually.
Yeah, treat's a good word. Yeah.
I was thinking that the whole notion of a culture treating an individual is automatically something of an insult to that culture. And I was thinking that in the East, at least hope in the East, that the individual has a self-concept that has... that stands independent of the way he is treated by his culture. And I would think, and I share your, what I would imagine is provincial interest in Western civilization, but I merely wish to establish that I think we not so much don't like, or I mean, think less of Eastern art or the East.
But I didn't imply that for one moment. I didn't imply that for one moment. I didn't talk about the relative value of Oriental or Far Eastern or exotic art. I wouldn't presume to. That's another question, and it's a curiously interesting one because we found out, thanks to modernist art, we found out in the last 100 years or so that art is universal, that you don't have to be an Indian in order to appreciate Hindu or Buddhist sculpture. But let's save that too, because when we get to the question of whether reactions to art are subjective or objective, we'll take that up. Remind me of that, would you?
All right, well, can I merely mention it so that I will remember to remind you? Yeah. And that's that here's the statement, which I'll save for later. That's what I think when we think of modern art, or of, let's say, art today, we have a very clearly, not only Western, but even New York City attitude about it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but...
we'll
save
that.
All right. Okay.
Good.
You have...
Just the spiritual relations have anything to do with the idea that you can't say anything about it?
No, I didn't say that nothing, we can't say anything about it. What I was leading to was to the statement that we can't put our finger on what makes a work of art good or less good or more good. We can't accept, well, tentatively but not probatively. And yes.
Well, I don't know, I may be confused, but it seems like you're saying that we can decide quality, but we can't define levels of quality.
We can't define, we can recognize levels
well,
of quality.
Well, wait a minute. You see, it seems to me that you're saying you can say that a work of art is either good or bad, right?
Or more good, less good.
Well, you just said now that's what, where it gets complicated.
So I said when it gets complicated when it comes to making that statement a probative one. I want to get on that tomorrow night.
It just seems like the issue of quality is like the only issue we can really relatively confront.
Yeah.
I mean, relatively, because it.
Well, that I want to. That's a big issue. I think as far as how art can be pertinently discussed. I avoid the word relevant because it's become so bedraggled lately. Yes, ma'am.
There's maybe a very simple confusion that we could clear up very easily, and that is the distinction between saying that art is valued for its own sake, which you've said, but we've also implied repeatedly that it's not valued for its own sake, but for the sake of something else, very particularly the spectator's experience, that is, the pleasure or interest that the artwork produces as its characteristic effect. Now, that's not valuing art for the sake of art, but art for the sake of the effect that it produces. And if that's so, then couldn't we consider and discourse on such questions as whether those valued effects are of a unique kind? Or, for example, if they're comparable to or shared by other experiences that we have. For example, just to name one, the experience of games. I would just wonder whether you consider that an open question, one that we could discourse on.
That is an open question. Schiller was the first one to try to define art as a form of play or relate art to play, and he had trouble with that because my own answer, which I'm hoping to save, and I'm aware right now that I plotted this first seminar in too skimpy a way, by the guys. See, we can't avoid going into certain questions. I happen to think play is a form of art, and I would agree with Schiller in a way that would surprise and shock him. But I think it's a very low-grade form of art, for the most part. Now, the question of valuing art for its own sake or for the experience it affords, that's what I'd call a scholastic distinction. All we know about art is the experience we have of it. That's the only... when we say art, we mean something we have experience of.
Well, not exactly. Experience of a work of art, for example, a painting, as a piece of canvas measurable, spots of
that's
paint.
Not experiencing it qua
and
art.
Experiencing it qua art.
Yeah, well, I said art, though. When I say art, I imply qua art. Not, all right, well, I'll say every time art as art. Art qua art. I'm not talking about objects. When I talk about music, I'm not talking about a succession of noises. I'm talking about an ordered succession of sounds that are music and unintelligible, we'll say, as anything but music. These are scholastic...
No, but it's not scholastic, because if you can make that distinction which you've just yourself made, or indeed exists, then you can consider the relation between those two. That is, the relation between the art object described as something else, for example, a physical object with dimensions, and the experience that you have of it as an artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And that then becomes an interesting question.
Yeah, it is an interesting question. And here I'm brought up against my own incompetence again. I'm not a philosopher, not a language philosopher, least of all a language philosopher. And it is an interesting subject, and I'm not putting it down. And the answers have been, incidentally, let me say that there have been attempts to explain or explicate the relation between the art object and as an object or as an indifferent sense experience and art as the experience of art. Someone like Suzanne Langer says that all works of art create a kind of illusion. They painted cloth creates a pictorial illusion. Dance creates illusion of dance, and so on. I agree with her, just as I agree with Sartre, that works of art are imaginative entities. Imaginative entities. That's his answer to the same question. Now, as far as I'm concerned, I think the difficulty is largely a verbal one, and largely an answer designed to check the new fashion can't. New fashion, it's 50 years old, about reducing painting or reducing sculpture to their physical substances. And words like non-referential have come in lately. All the words of journalists. But there was talk about the tableau objet before 1914 in connection with Cubism. You emphasize the physical qualities of a painting instead of trying to conceal the fact it's paint on canvas or and that the canvas is on a stretcher or whatever. You call attention to these facts explicitly. In calling attention to these facts in an artistic way, even though it's in a bad artistic way, you're getting no nearer that their self-identity, the self-identity of the canvas or the paint, the actual pigment, than you are when you paint a trompe l'oeil cup on it. Again, the work of art eludes you the way a pellet of mercury does. And Sartre was right, and Dr. Langer is right. Art is by way of being an illusion or an imaginary is the wrong word. I forget Sartre's French. But anyhow, an entity that belongs to the imagination. I don't know. I happen to think this is important, what you brought up, only in dealing with so much contemporary journalism about art. So the artists who, as the minimal artists and others, claim that they're, and this claim, of course, has been made for the past periodically, well, it's been made either as a claim or made as a charge or accusation that art from now on is going to be entirely different from what it has been up to now. And now art is no longer, so you can read in art magazines, is no longer going to be this shabby thing called an illusion. It's going to be the real thing, the real piece of steel, and the real piece of wood, and the real piece of plastic, and the real piece of string, and so on. And said by artists and art journalists who, for the largest part, and here I am getting off the subject, don't have much taste, anyhow. Oh, and no real position to talk about, let's say, such things, or make such claims of any sort.
Yeah. What do you mean when you talk about taste and that context?
Well, I'm getting to that all again. Taste, the capacity to appreciate, which in turn means the capacity to experience more fully works of art, good and bad.
Well, is there a certain standard applied in that?
Oh, yeah, but we can't put it into words.
But you've used many times, and specifically in the case of pop art, the phrase, it is merely an episode in taste.
Not many times, just once.
Well,
I just said one.
All right, memorable. Memorable, how's that? But it's a phrase that Stock and several of us have used. We have used many times the phrase you used once.
Thank you.
The concept there, taste in the majority. And you've just established it as a...
I use taste as a metaphor, and one of these loaded metaphors, and I should really, and it teaches me something about how really entirely you should be in using language. There's the taste of the art public, and there's art at the same time, and I make this provisional division between them. And the best art of our time, as it happens, and as it has happened over the last 100 years or more, has run on largely separate in the short term, each phase of art, from the taste of the larger public for art. And the demonstration of that is that, let's say, Eugène Carrière, who was a pretty good painter, was far more famous in 1900 than Cézanne was, and really more famous than any of the Impressionists, except possibly Monet, you know. And we've got so many examples of that since the time of Corot on, in painting, and we have it in literature too, and we have it in music. And so in describing what goes on for the art public that, say, adores Bastien Lepage, but doesn't even think a painting by Pissarro is a mess of paint, we say the art public that admired Bastien Lepage participated in the history of taste rather than the history of art. That's what I mean. And it's curious here. Histories of taste have been written in a slapdash way, but no one has tried to write what I suppose I would call an anatomy of taste, as taste is operated for the largest art public since Corot's or Monet's time. the regularities in which, in the way in which taste is operated. The best new art of a given moment is like a projectile whose speed is such that it meets greater resistance than the less than best new art of that given moment. And this repeats itself so regularly from it repeats itself not only every generation, every dozen years, it repeats itself every 2 or 3 years. And we can see that right in front of us. Pick up any art magazine. And if someone would try to do a history of taste that took account of the fact that Victor Benard, B-S-N-A-R-D, who came up in the 1880s, saw what the Impressionists were doing, made what they were doing more palatable, and immediately outsold Sisley and Pissarro, and to their grief, and became better known too for the short term. And he's not a despicable painter either, by the way. I mean, if someone wrote a history of taste, or anatomy of taste, taking account of facts like that, it would, I think, be very enlightening and would tell us ever so much about what goes on what's called the art scene today. We'd see recurrences, irregularities that would be very, I'd feel it would be very enlightening and very, also very discomforting to some people.
Well, that leads, if I may ask another question, how do you explain the hostility that I mentioned in the introduction here tonight? How do you explain the hostility to, let's say, just for the purpose of discussion, your definition of quality, or the kind of art that embodies your definition of quality? How do you explain that today? Is merely an episode in taste?
I'd like to flatter myself and say that that's what it was. I mean, sure, that's what I think it is, but I'm not going to...
I mean, you can't...
tell you people here that that's what it certainly has to be.
I mean, well, you...
I'm not sure yet.
Well, would you compare what's happening today with some of the conditions that you just illustrated, using people like Benard, well, let's say Alfred Stevens or Carrière, any of those?
Stevens, good painter, too.
Yeah, you know, he was considered better than Monet.
I know.
Would you say that a proposition that Roy Lichtenstein is, say, a better painter than, well, name anyone you want to name, I'd rather not.
You do the naming, please.
Well, would you, that Roy Lichtenstein, even the followers of Roy Lichtenstein wouldn't say that, but some of the fellow travelers of pop art might say that Roy Lichtenstein is, say, a better painter than Jackson Pollock. Would you say that is comparable to someone saying that Alfred Stevens? Since I feel that Lichtenstein has some quality, would you say that's comparable to... to Stevens being, you would almost have
preferred
to
Manet. To, yeah, I do. It's very comparable.
You don't feel that there's a kind of overlooking all the political rabble-rousing and self-serving public relations devices. You don't feel that there's a particular urgency, which, if not moral, might be considered historical to the present uprising and uproar and the avant-garde?
Now, when you use the word urgency,
yeah,
would you explain yourself?
Well, I have to say that I feel that urgency. That puts it on a... and I really didn't want to get into the debates that we have conducted other places about similar issues, but to me, urgency By urgency, I mean all the steps that you have to take to renew quality.
To do precisely what Manet, half felt he had to do.
Now that would leave it sort of hanging in limbo in a highly
We're abstract. Talking about what keeps the avant-garde, the real avant-garde going.
Now I have to say the types of art that embody that.
Are you about to talk about your own?
No, I'm not about your own.
I'm afraid you are. It's approaching.
As I said, I began by saying urgency because I couldn't escape my own frame of reference.
I don't, but
it's as valid as any for compelling you to pin this issue of quality down. Since I share all...
We're talking about the history of quality
the
now.
The history of quality. And the history of quality has been embodied by lots of different kinds of art.
Right.
I'm not talking about content.
The specificity.
Literal... The
specificity.
Yeah. All right. The specificity.
Well, that's the best word I can think of.
It's perhaps more specific than context.
Yeah.
The specificity.
Look, may I just say this? I want to take it back to the rest of the audience.
Yeah.
I think that what started the avant-garde, and in painting I think it began with Manet, not Courbet, not Delacroix or Corot, was the feeling that the painting he saw around him in his time in the 1850s was not up to the standards of the old masters, the best of the old masters. I don't say this is a conscious program. I say it, was, it seemed to me something half-conscious. When Manet complained that the painting he saw around him in Paris was full of soups and gravies, he was complaining about the dull colors, the neutral, the neutrals they were using to shade with and the swallowing, painting up and shading. And he set out to brighten painting again, as it were, because bright painting was more like the painting of the old masters, at least the old masters before the mid-17th century. We know Manet painted in blacks and whatnot, but they were brighter blacks. They weren't neutrals. And that every succeeding phase of avant-garde art adhered to that mission. We're going to make it as good as the old masters. Even in the case of painters like Pollock and Morris Lewis, who had to stay away from the museums because they felt either wrongly, as Pollock did, that we do it better now than the old masters. I still think he was dead wrong. Or as Lewis felt was that if he got into the National Gallery in Washington, the old masters would infect him. He'd want to do something like that in their specific way, and he felt their specific way could amount to result in nothing but syrupy painting for him. And that remains the mission of the true avant-garde, the classic avant-garde, the authentic avant-garde, to maintain the best standards of the past. And now it's the whole past. Well, whether it's Old Kingdom Egyptian sculpture or whether it's a Chinese painting at the end of Tang time, or a medieval Japanese sculpture, or whether it's a so-called medieval Hindu sculpture, and so on. Or whether it's Greek sculpture in 500 BC. The point is, we want to try to make art as good as it's ever been made. And that's it as far as I see it. Yes.
Do you have any preconceived aims
or goal these seminars and if so, I'd like to know what they are. And if you have a program, could you give a program? You say, well, we'll save this question for tomorrow.
Yeah, well.
Do you have any ideas or?
I have ideas for the next three or four. And I have still further ideas for the following ones. I was trying to stage this so that I could get to what I have to say that might arouse the most disagreement among you till later on, because I have things to say that I think will provoke a lot of disagreement. What I have to say is my attempt to explain why what seems the most radical advanced art of this time, what seems is actually a new form of academic art, a new avatar of academic art. Now, it's easy enough to feel that with your sensibility. But it's very hard to reconcile the spectacular novelties of far-out art in this time, the spectacular novelty with academic, I feel is academic sensibility. We know that in the past, what seems spectacular novelty always coincided with truly original and truly advanced art. I don't mean, when I say advanced, I don't mean that advanced art is necessarily better, though down at bottom it is necessarily better, but I won't get into that now. What I mean by that, I think Leonardo was more advanced than Andrea del Castagno. Not that he was better, but in order to be as good as Andrea, and now I'm getting off the subject, he had to advance. That is, in order for Leonardo to be at least as good as Giotto, he had to be an advanced artist. In order for Monet to be as good as Goya, or anywhere near as good,